On this week's Devils in the Details, a revisit of last week's dramatic FA Cup win over Liverpool, the best moments, and some thoughts on fixture hero Amad Diallo. As well, what are the chances of United converting this cup run into silverware during a maligned season? All right, Case, how was that game last week? I mean, I know it doesn't really fix some of the issues we've been talking about all season, but that's got to be what the game's all about, right? A 120th minute win against Liverpool scored by a United, not really United Academy graduate, but a young player who a lot of people are excited about.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most fun I've had watching a United match in a very, 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 very long time. Talk about dramatic. Like, do you think it would have been better if Rashford had scored in regular time to win it? Or do you think it's better that it worked out the way it did? I think it's better than
I don't know.
That
I think either would
did.
Be incredible, but
extra time was better than that would have been.
I actually think United played quite well in extra time in comparison to how they played for the rest of the season. So it was kind of nice to see them, you know, they went down and then actually played their way back into the game. And outplayed the Liverpool side, which, I mean, tiredness obviously taken into account, but outplayed the Liverpool side for actual stretches of that match. And whether that says that United are good or Liverpool are bad, I'll let you decide, but it was incredible to watch.
I don't think it has to say either. I don't think it has to say either. It was fun to watch. It was a good time. If United could do that with regularity, that would be awesome. I think that's all we're hoping for.
Yeah. I mean, I think the FA Cup, and in many ways this win, are kind of antithetical to many of the things that we talk about on this podcast, because you put the teams in an environment where extreme amounts of variance, crazy events, and all kinds of different heroes can emerge. Anything can happen. There's really no use predicting this stuff, which, I mean, we're about to talk about United's chances of winning the cup, but there's really no use predicting this stuff. It's all just a bit of fun. I think this, honestly, I think in the modern era where league play is getting so optimized and teams are getting so much closer to perfect than I think ever before, I honestly think this is a healthy, welcome, exciting break for neutrals just to watch some even, fun, exciting, unpredictable, dramatic football matches.
So what do you mean by this is, you know, there's no point in predicting this? Because what makes this any different from, you know, a league match where United go out and outplay Liverpool for stretches, albeit in a flawed manner? Obviously, United give up two whole expected goals, play very poorly throughout the second half. So this is not me saying like United trampled Liverpool, to any neutrals listening, I guess. But yeah, what do you mean by that? Because I think I understand what you mean, but I wonder if those listening don't.
Yeah, it's less about individual match circumstances and more about the fact that the things we talk about on this podcast are more about how to win broadly over the course of 38 games, how to consistently win over the course of a league season. When we say dominating the opposition leads to winning, we mean that in broad strokes. If you dominate the opposition in 10 games, you'll win a high proportion of those games, as opposed to saying every game you dominate, you'll win. And cups just introduce a level of, you know, if you lose once, you're out. It's not about who wins the most games. I mean, in theory it is, but it's more about who wins the most consecutive games, which in many ways is a coin toss and also invites different tactical elements, such as, you know,
Bruno Fernandes
specifically
at
trying not to lose. Bruno Fernandes at center back, and Antony at left back, and Christian Eriksen as a lone midfielder launching the ball into the opposition half. United trying all kinds of different things because, you know, it's not about optimizing the next game. There is no next game if you lose. It just creates a different circumstance to league play. And I think, one, I think it gives some optimism and hope to teams that are kind of consigned to being in that part of the Premier League where they're basically free of relegation, but lacking in the excitement of maybe European football or winning the league. And it also just introduces some variability, introduces a different style of football to league matches and shows us how many of the characteristics of how we perceive and analyze the game are about how the competition is structured, not necessarily about how the game itself is played. And I think that just makes it so much fun.
Yeah, I like that last bit the point that you made. A lot in there, a lot in that answer. I think I totally agree with you about the cup. Honestly, I think there is a space within which, you know, let me approach this differently. More resources should be put into the FA Cup, in my opinion. I think it's really important for the game for a variety of reasons. I think it's very sad that the modern fan cares less about it and that it's become this secondary trophy, because I get that it's not the Champions League or the Premier League, but that was not the attitude of most fans if you go back even 20 years. And I don't think it has to be that way. Like, I don't think we have to regard it like that. And I'm not saying this because United advanced a round. I'm saying this because I totally agree. It adds life to, you know, sides like United, who probably don't have a lot to play for the rest of the season. There are other clubs like that. And yeah, also change the circumstances within which these top sides play each other, change the reward system, the value choices that you make in a given match, because like you said, there's a chance you won't have another match to play. I think it creates exciting football in the right context, and it certainly did this past week. So totally on the same page with you. It was really fun. I almost went to a United fan bar to watch the match, and I really wish I had, because I wound up just sitting at home watching it and screaming. Actually, I was sitting in my friend's apartment. We were moving him into a new apartment, so they were carrying couches, and I was looking at my phone. I think that's that on at least the aura of that match, which there certainly was a lot of.
Relatedly, I mean, United are now in the semifinal, and they're playing Coventry. Do you actually think this is another cup final run on the cards, and do you think United have a decent shot at winning this thing?
I don't know. Yes. I mean, clearly. I wouldn't be surprised if we have the best odds. I'll bet you we at least have the second best odds to win it. I don't know. I don't trust us to beat Coventry, but we certainly should. So, we'll see. We'll see. I think for me, it's less about silverware and it's more about moments. That's something that I'm coming to more and more as a fan of the sport, that, you know, that 120th minute winner will mean more to me than just winning a cup final. Like, the cup finals become moments in and of themselves, but like, I am chasing that high from that match. And that obviously, you get more of those moments when you're playing well. So this is not me saying, like, don't try to win. I just mean, that's why I think the cups are awesome. Not because they're a chance at silverware, but because they're a chance at excitement.
Yeah, that's fair. And it does feel like, in many ways, a lot like last year's FA Cup, where United just didn't have enough to get over the line in the final, but it really does feel like this could end up being, and already has been in many ways, a bright spot in an otherwise very, very difficult season.
Yeah, totally agree. And don't you think it's funny that we've gotten results against Liverpool this year, of all years?
Yeah, I mean, in the Anfield game, United conceded like 35, 36 shots.
Right, but I said results. like we went to Anfield and we didn't concede. When was the last time we did that? I can't remember.
Speaking of the result, it was Amad Diallo who scored the winner. Ahmad has not really played this season and hasn't really played for United over the years, despite joining for a relatively big fee in 2020. Case, do you think Ahmad has a chance of being involved towards the end of the season? And if he is involved towards the end of the season, notwithstanding his suspension, obviously, for taking his shirt off after scoring the winner, do you think he could cement a spot in the squad going into future seasons? Do you think he has ability to do that? Do you have concerns? We had a couple questions about this actually as well, so I'll read those off as well. Abdel asks, do you think Ahmad's most effective position is out wide or closer to a 10? He seems to like to drift inside and link up, similar to Sancho, just like how we got center attacking midfield or Camcho towards the end. We will get Kamad. Wakar asks, follow-up question on Ahmad and if he can actually play central or a similar role to Bernardo Silva. I think the comparisons there, because they're both left-footed and have similar physical stature. Case, what do you think Ahmad's prospects are, someone who's been watching him, I know, for a number of years?
I definitely think that he has a chance to be a squad member. I think the big I think he showed enough, even in that cameo, to see that he has qualities that other players that have been getting minutes don't have. So
cameo?
Cameo. First of all, I'm just going to, quick aside, cam, the word cam, or the acronym cam, is a FIFA-ism. It doesn't mean anything. It's from a video game. No one's, central attacking midfielder is not a term, or it's only a term because of a video. Anyway, that gets into linguistics and whatever. I don't like it.
It's an EAFC term.
Yes. Anyway, I digress. Yes, I do think Ahmad can do it. There's still huge question marks. That was a short cameo in very specific circumstances. So I tend to think that he is better in central areas, largely because I don't think he has the pace to beat players out wide, which is funny because when I first looked at him 5 years ago, I thought his standout trait was his dribbling. And now that I've even gone back and looked at that tape, and I don't feel that way anymore. You can see there's a lack of burst. Similar to the way you could see there was a lack of burst with Sancho. But nevertheless, I think he's very technically consistent. And I also just don't think he's played enough. I will always say this. You need a ton of minutes to know what a player really is. And he has not gotten a ton of minutes at Premier League level. And what he did do in the Championship last season was encouraging. So we have no reason not to give him, 800, 1,000 minutes between now and the end of the season. All comps. Why not?
In fairness, we have about 1,200 minutes left of the season, all comps, but
my point stands. Who is pushing him out of the side?
I do think Rashford, Hoyland, and Garnacho are going to continue to start in the front three, and Bruno's going to continue to start behind them, which makes it difficult for him to get into the side. But I do think he's worth a handful of starts and substitute appearances in almost every game he doesn't start.
I just think that if you want to actually make an assessment, you need to start him.
I agree with that. I don't think you can question whether that's going to happen.
Yeah, perhaps.
At least until the Champions League is mathematically over. I still don't think Champions League is going to happen, but I definitely think it's something that Ten Hag is going to be going for. He can't really throw in the towel because it would, by all intents and purposes, be throwing in the towel on his job.
I think there's an outcome where he comes in sixth, wins the FA Cup, and keeps his job.
Where he comes in fifth and loses it, though. So I feel like it could go any way, but I definitely think Champions League qualification is a major objective of his position and something that the team was targeting this season, and something that we earmarked as a target at the start of the season.
Yeah.
I did watch a lot of Ahmad's loan spot Sunderland. I think he was good at Championship level. Very clearly a level ahead in terms of ball striking, just general manipulation of the ball, creative passing and ball carrying into dangerous areas.
I was just going to say, I think he was good at all of those things. I don't think he was clearly a level above the championship, though. I think that's the real like question mark here.
So that's where I was gonna get. So yeah, he I think he was good at those things. I think if you put him in a room with 10 championship players, he's probably better than at least 7 or 8 of them. I think what impressed me about his game at championship level was his ability to hold off players despite his size, retain the ball in tight spaces, and out wide. And then also his ability to not get lost in wide areas. So when he received in really wide areas, he had the ball striking and control to stay involved in the game, which is actually something that I think is quite difficult at this level when you're a smaller, not blisteringly quick winger. I think you're right. He wasn't phenomenal at championship level. He went on a scoring run, but a lot of it was based on overperforming his expected numbers, which weren't really that high.
They were pretty low, quite frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, they were lower than what United's players at the time, like even players like Antony and, you know, what McTominay is doing this season in the Premier League right now. So it's not really like he was playing at the level in the championship such that it was like, insert him into the team now. I think a lot of that is due to physical limitations. Like, I think when you're a player of his size and stature, you have to be basically one of the best players in the world on a technical basis in order to play for United, I think, or at least to play regularly for United. I think that's where the Bernardo Silva comparisons are interesting. Like, first of all, I think Bernardo Silva is a deceptively huge ground coverage player as an athlete. He can cover ground quickly, efficiently, and all match. And we're yet to see whether Ahmad can do something like that. And secondly, he is technically phenomenal. He can dribble out of pressure effortlessly. His passing is generally very good. He's relatively strong in creative areas, especially when deployed in a number 8 position. I think he's a standout player relative to players in deep-lying midfield roles from an attacking point of view. We're yet to see whether Ahmad can do things like that. And I think that's the level, technically, he would have to be at to be a regular starter for United. But right now, I do think there's a possibility he could be involved in a squad capacity. I do think the move might be to try him a little deeper in like an advanced midfield role instead of a wing role where his pace matters a little bit less. And then that'll be dependent on his defensive application and his ability to retain the ball in those tighter spaces, slightly deeper spaces. And if he can do that, I think there's a decent chance he could be a squad player in midfield for United. I think there's a smaller chance, but I guess higher floor at right wing. So overall, I'm not saying like this is a player who's going to be heavily involved for years to come, but I'm not without hope for him. And I mean, that goal was a fantastic take. It wasn't just a simple 120th minute counter goal. Like he is a very good ball striker and really knows how to time and control the ball and has really strong close control with the ball close to his body. So there's a lot there.
Yeah. Yeah, I agreed. The last thing I would add here is the following. While I do think he can become a squad player, I do think that if you're not super talented, it's difficult to keep a player who doesn't have a clear role within which they can apply their skills and add value. So it's just tough. You can have star players where it's not like they don't fit perfectly in if they're just so good that it doesn't really matter. But you can't really do that with a squad player because they don't have the overwhelming talent to, you know, cover up their blemishes. So,
yeah.
I don't know. That's just a thought. But we'll see. It's very possible. I would not close the door on it.
Another thing I'd say that's interesting about Ahmad is that he, I think, does tend to get into some interesting goal-scoring positions, which means that I don't think he's actually that reliant on being, like, a high-usage ball player, which tends to matter a lot when you're a squad attacking player at a high level. If you're a player who needs the ball 50, 60 times a game to make an impact, it becomes more likely that you'll end up being a star for a bottom half team where the team is built around you than, you know, a squad player for a top half team where you're playing once or twice a month, you come into the side, and it isn't really geared towards getting you the ball every single time. That every single time the team enters the final third. So I think that could also make him useful at this level. Overall, I think I'm relatively optimistic this could be a top flight player. I'm like, I think it's relatively unlikely he could be a United player. And I do think there are reasons he hasn't been playing this season, but I don't think it's impossible yet. And I do think he's deserving of a chance. A, after that goal, and B, considering the money United have spent on him, and C, considering his ability level in comparison to other options United have to play in the front three, and as well as a deputy to Bruno.
Agreed.
Awesome. All right. Let's go to a couple of questions we had from people on Twitter today. There are a couple of really good ones. Another player who was really good in this match was Kabi Mainoo. We've been talking about Kabi Mainoo for half the season, but Sam asks, do you have a strong sense of Mainoo's best role, and how would you build around him? I think this is a really interesting question, honestly, because I think we've seen flashes of attacking impact, but not huge attacking impact, and I think we've seen the same defensively. Most of what we've seen from Mainoo is honestly very strong in possession involvement, and I would also argue flashes of very strong in possession involvement. So I feel like it could be easy to be left wondering whether he's a player who needs positional rigidity, positional freedom, whether he's a player who is best staying deep, or a player who should be given freedom to advance. Case, what do you think? And how would you plan a midfield around Mainoo for the next few seasons if that's what you think United should be doing?
It's an interesting question. I think right now his value is predominantly in early phases. I also think you're always going to want him to be involved in early phases. I don't think that's ever going to change, just because there are very few players who can do what he does there. That said, he has had a few moments now against Wolves, multiple moments against Liverpool, where he's done things in the final third that even fewer players can do in football than what he does in early phases. And I'm talking specifically about his ability to just tear through a low block off the dribble. It's really a unique skill, and it's of such immense value that I'm not going to call anyone who thinks that is very important an idiot, because they're not. So I don't want to take a super strong stance on this, but I will say I wouldn't push him up high and like remove him of responsibilities in early phases, just because I think that skill is so rare. But maybe he winds up being such an incredible dribbler that you just use that skill wherever, as often as you can, wherever you can. Otherwise, I don't know that you build the midfield around him. You build the midfield with his skill set in consideration, but I don't think you should be moving forward saying like, oh, Mainoo is going to be the best guy in this midfield, and therefore we should, you know, set things up around him. I think you should be looking to get two players who are better than him, and that's not because I think he's bad, but because I think that should always be your aspiration. Like, the next buy should always, you should always be attempting to buy the best player on your team. Like when you're buying for the starting lineup, there's no reason not to. So yeah, I don't know, but I think if you absolutely force my hand here, I'd say he's a six, but you pair him with somebody else who plays deeper when you're in possession and gives him some freedom to get involved, in wide areas and dribbling with the ball, and in combination play. But out of possession, I think he's a six. And I think in early phases, he's a six. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think the way I'd boil it down is this. Firstly, regardless of where you play him, I think you're going to need at least one midfielder who has more athleticism than him in your midfield.
I think you probably need two.
Maybe two.
Quite frankly, I think you need two.
that's regardless of whether he's a 6, 8, or 10. I don't think he's a 10, but throwing that in there. Secondly, I think the argument for playing him more advanced than a 6 might be that he is smaller than some of the players playing number 6 for Premier League clubs right now, particularly as a single pivot. I don't think he's going to have the level of dual competency as a player like Declan Rice or Rodri, or even a player like Endo, who I don't think is as talented as Mainu, but has been an important presence for Liverpool in specific matches this season. I think the argument for playing him deeper is that, like you said, he is perhaps a generational first phase build-up player, and also I think you might find that his attacking ceiling is limited, and United need to be getting as much attacking quality into this team as they possibly can at the top end. Players like Bruno coming to mind. I think the variable will end up being how good he is at attacking. If he turns out to be a player who's going to give you a goal involvement every three games in a number eight position, then you kind of have to give him license again to the final third, because those would be huge involvements. But if he isn't, then I think he would likely be a midfielder who contributes in build-up and then ends up as part of a rest defensive structure in the final third, where he is constantly behind the ball, and then he has license to pick out passes behind a block or run at a block when and if a midfield partner or fullback covers for his run, which would be a relatively restricted attacking role. The second thing I'll say here is I really do want to fixate on the point about not necessarily building around him. This is something that I've kind of spoken about on Twitter and probably implied on here many times, but I really just think you aren't really looking at a fixed starting 11, fixture proof, all season, every game, and then looking to buy 11 players who are going to fill your starting 11. I really think you want a set of skills and a set of roles, and then players who can give you those skills and roles, whether that's, I think you have to have at least 15, but I think it's more likely to be 17, 18, maybe even 19 players who are going to give you those skills over the course of a season. And I think that's a very different proposition. You might come up against a team where they press you really high and you want to build through them, but once you build through them, they're very defensively open. And so in a game like that, you want a second midfielder who's a lot like Kobbie Mainoo, maybe, to pair alongside him. Alternatively, you might have a game where a team goes long and tries to hit their very tall attacking midfielder in build-up, and then you might not want to play Mainoo at all because the team's not going to press at all, which I think is a key driver of Mainoo's value, is that he's a press-resistant player who can play through opposition, which means his value is higher in matches where the opposition press. So you might go, oh, maybe in that kind of match, I want a tall defensive midfielder whose slightly more limited ability on the ball isn't actually a problem in terms of playing through that opposition block. That player will be able to pick his passes anyways. You want to just build a team of as many good players as possible who can fit different roles and adapt to different scenarios, provide you goals in different ways, prevent goals consistently. And Mainoo is definitely a player who should be a part of that, but I hesitate to say a team should be building a fixed starting 11 around star players who then become irreplaceable, because it causes problems lasting throughout a season, and it causes problems when those players become unavailable at different points in the season.
Yeah, I agree with what you just said. I wouldn't maybe take it as far as you took it. I do think there will be players who play 45 90s, 50, like maybe even 50 90s,
yeah,
by design.
I think you'll have 3 or 4.
Yeah. Sure. Yes, but I also think, yeah, yes. My follow-up to that is, I do think there's a decent chance that Mainoo winds up being one of those players who there aren't matches where you don't want him in the side just because he's so
overwhelmingly... I think that was an extreme example.
Yeah.
I think it's worth noting that the final version of this player is probably a huge value add passer in every phase, whereas right now I think he is mostly a high value add carrier. and then like a reasonably good and clean passer at this level, I think you're going to see a lot more range and a lot more line breaking from him as he develops. And I think that's going to make him relatively indispensable because those players are just non-existent in Europe.
Yeah. If he develops even very good passing range, he will be one of the best midfielders in Europe. Right now, I would say he's a fine passer. He's technically very sound, but the adventurousness is not there right now.
Yeah. I agree with that. And yeah, so you can go on then. I think I got you halfway through your point.
Well, I think that was really most of the point. The only other thing that I would add is... No, that's probably it, to be honest. I think... The thing about Mainoo that is the worry is... What level is he physically going to settle at, and is it going to be a level that limits your, you know, team athleticism? And as long as you find him a role, as long as he settles in at a level that's not like unfieldably bad in terms of his physical level, which I don't think that's going to be ultimately going to prevent him from playing for United. The thing that is left for you to do is to surround him with physicality, like you mentioned, Aaron. And so to the extent that I would say, how do you build around him? You buy lots of footballers who are physically elite, because he's not going to be physically elite. And if you see him as indispensable, then everyone else needs to be.
Great. Let's move on to another question here. A couple of quickfire, maybe Q&A type questions. Michael asks, there's been the typical international break ridiculous tweets over the last few days, but one about Luke Shaw caught the eye. Do you think his lack of assists has been a hindrance, or do you think he has more than made up for it in other ways? What's his best attribute for you?
I don't think his lack of assists has been a hindrance. I think he's... When he's been fit, he's been one of the best left backs in football. Best attribute, he's got excellent passing range. He's a very, very good ball carrier. I would say probably his ball carrying. Yeah. Going forward, he's a very, very good fullback. I don't think assists are not the be-all, end-all of attacking contribution for fullbacks, in my opinion.
No. I think... You want to look at contributions that lead to chances, but not directly passing into the shooter.
Yeah.
I mean, I think why this is interesting is I think Shaw is one of the best left backs in football when he's fully available. I think he would have been even better had, you know, he not faced a number of physical challenges in his career that were in no way his fault. However, I do think he is 29.
Yes. And that's the part of this question that... That's why when I heard this question, it wasn't that I didn't have an answer. It's that it's not the thing that I think about when I think of Shaw now. The thing that I think about when I think of Shaw is he going to play a full season as the starting left back again for United? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I think he's too good to consider getting rid of. But then
I'm not
also
saying
get
rid of him. I'm just saying
yeah, I know.
Think you need to have somebody who, if Shaw is... completely unavailable the whole season, you're comfortable with them playing every single minute at left back.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, and that's kind of where I was heading with this, is I feel like Luke Shaw's absence has been a huge issue the entire season, and anyone denying it is clearly not seeing an aspect of how United play with him versus without him, to the point where I think United are honestly going to try and replicate what he does, or replicate the level of impact that he has with another left back this summer. I don't think that's a questioning of his ability to play the role. I think it's a statement of his importance and the fact that when he's not available, you need someone who is close to just as good or just as good as him, which I don't even think you're really going to get.
Yeah, totally agree. Something that a friend of mine and Aaron's, who works at one of the larger clubs in Serie A, often remarks on is that so few top clubs in Europe have two usable left-footed left backs, and those that do benefit from it to a massive degree. It's just a weird distortion within football that there are as many clubs as there are that will only keep one left-footed left back. And obviously United have more than one. Malacia, we don't really know what's going on, but I really do think this is a key point. You should have, really at every position, two players who can play every minute, and you're not crossing your fingers hoping that the starter comes back. And I think at left back, it's just particularly clear because the result in terms of how it affects team shape when you have a right footer at left back, and also how it affects your wing defending, are just massive and very visible.
Yeah. I mean, fingers crossed for Malacia. There are a couple of players in the academy who many believe will become options in the coming seasons, but we're also going to talk about a number of left backs that we think United could sign this summer that would elevate their ability to perform without Shaw available. As we get more information about who's going to be managing and what they're likely to be looking for in those positions, I think this is one of the positions where that'll be a little more important, because if you get a manager who's playing a back three, I do think that slightly changes the requirements of what you're looking for in this position, because they're going to be playing either left wing back or left center back, as opposed to playing left back in a back four. Awesome. All right. Prince asks, which player do you think in our team would thrive more in the 2000s era of football compared to now? And which player do you think from the 2000s would thrive more in the current era compared to then?
Current player from the 2000s who I think would survive in the current era.
You can do the
I'd rather do the hard one first. I think Nani is the one that comes to mind. I think Nani would probably start for Manchester City. That's my take is
oh, that's going to be a sound bit. All right.
Yeah. I think if you take Nani from he's still a modern footballer. Like, I probably should have gone 10 years earlier, but that's the one that comes to mind, is I think his skill set was valuable then. I think now it's even more valuable. Like, a player who can genuinely beat opposition in isolation on the right wing and has an elite final ball. Those two things are so, so, so critical. So I think that's my take. Otherwise, yeah, it's tough. I feel like the reverse is a lot easier. I think Bruno is the immediate one that comes to mind, current player who would be dominant in the mid-2000s. I think the kind of chaotic football that he espouses was the dominant form of football at the highest level 20 years ago. And so I don't think people would even consider him a standout in terms of his wastefulness if you go back and watch early 2000s football. Like, I think you would be astonished if you actually, go back and watch five matches of Man United in 2004 or 2001. The ball is pinging all over the place, man. It's crazy. It was just a different game. It's not a value judgment. It just... Yeah, so I think any player whose game is less predicated on ball retention, press resistance, those are the players that I think you send them back 20 years and their skills perhaps play up.
I mean, if Pogba was still playing for United, that would be ridiculous. And Bruno would have been my choice as well, but I'll pick a different player. Case and I have been talking about how strikers and second strikers are kind of coming back in the big teams. You've seen Arsenal sign Havertz, and City playing Alvarez in midfield as well. And I think this is in an attempt to add box presence from different areas of the pitch. Getting a player who can fulfill the defensive and some of the possession responsibilities of a midfielder. But then once you get into the final third, get into the box and be a secondary outlet to create chances. I think that's driven by an increase in the importance of pressing. I think that's driven in an increase in the importance of breaking down low blocks. And I think United's version of that this season has been that McTominay has added a lot more value because of his performances in this advanced role. And when I say performances, I mean ability to get off particularly headers, but occasionally shots in the box. So I actually feel like if you went back to the mid-2000s, I don't think he would have started for United because United had these elite strike pairings, but I think he would have scored goals consistently and been largely regarded as controversially, because I think he divides opinion quite a bit, but I think we would have regarded him as a better player than perhaps we have for much of the last few years because of his deployment in deeper midfield roles as a result of the fact that the team hasn't really been looking to use two strikers or emulate second strikers in many matches.
Possibly. I think he also openly professes to be a midfielder. He's answered questions before where he said, yeah, I only play striker in a pinch. I'm a midfielder. I see myself as a midfielder.
Yeah, but I don't think he would play as the lone striker. I think he'd play someone like, I don't know, you had Rooney or Tevez, or you had like Van Nistelrooy, and yeah, you have someone like McTominay as a secondary runner off types of players.
I could see him be a 12 to 15 goal a season, second, one of two center forwards in a 4-4-2 20 years ago, but I don't know about for United.
Yeah, I think that comes down to the fact that United just had elite strike pairings. And like my answer from the 2000s after you took Nani was actually going to be Van Nistelrooy. I feel like it's a bit of a cheat because he was already cracked in the 2000s.
Yeah,
but
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, Nani had some insane seasons for United, so I'm also kind of cheating.
I just feel like a lot of people think the traditional striker is dying, whereas I think it's coming back. And he was the like epitome of that. So I suspect, like, if you watch old games of Van Nistelrooy, the way he just like crashed the net from all kinds of different positions, I think that would just translate directly. I think it's like north of 95% of his United goals were scored from inside the penalty area. It's a staggeringly high number. And I think more and more teams are looking to have two strikers who can do that, which they did in the 2000s, but I don't think they did in the 2010s. So I guess my answer is he would be close to equally as good, and as opposed to better, but I do think that direction is harder. It's harder to take players from an era where the game wasn't advanced as it is now and say players would get better in the light of more tactical imposition than before.
Okay, I've got another one. I think United fans who lived through him playing for United...
Oh, wait, sorry. The obvious answer is also Carrick. Sorry, I forgot to throw that
Carrick,
in. I think Carrick would be super valuable. But he also played in the mid-2010s.
Like, yeah.
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 Go ahead.
The other answer that I would give, that I think United fans who lived through him playing for United would say is an obvious answer, and is maybe even cheating, but I think within the zeitgeist, within like the discussion of him as a footballer, this has been lost, is David Beckham. I think David Beckham would play for City, would start for City. And I think...
Oh, yeah.
I think it's become... I think the general public has lost touch with that fact. He's become, you know, the first major footballer to go to the MLS. He was married to Posh Spice. He is married to Posh Spice. You know, now he's the director of Inter Miami. But first he was one of the great technicians in the history of English football.
Yeah, it's an interesting pick because he was a Ballon d'Or contender when United won the treble, I'm pretty sure. And he also played right midfield in a 4-4-2. So I guess my follow-up question for you would be, I mean, I'm not denying it, Beckham, like, obviously, when you have that level of technical ability, and I also think playing in the four in that midfield would probably be one of the positions that translates the best physically to the demands of the modern game.
Yeah, I was going to say.
What position do you think he would play in United's current 4-2-3-1? Do you think he just play right wing, or do you think he play right back, or do you think he plays central midfield?
No. He plays central midfield, I think. He plays central midfield.
Like in the pivot or like Bruno's role?
Like Bruno's role. Yeah. But maybe more like Eriksen's role last season.
I would pay money to see that.
I mean, I think people also forget that he was also...
He played midfield a reasonable amount.
He was very, very capable of running. Especially early in his career. He was very, very, like, willing to get gritty. Like, not that he was ever, like, a great technical tackler, but I think compared to some of the players you see play nowadays in these creative roles, he was much, much more violent of a player than, like, Bruno even.
Yeah. I mean, I think in this process, the older players that we've chosen are kind of timeless in the way they played, and the newer players we've chosen are kind of chaotic. But I think I also think there's something to be said about, and we've been talking about this a lot off the pod, but something to be said about like this reversion to like Yerdah attributes in the way that you and I talk about the game, where the importance of like big, strong, tall, fast, covers lots of ground, puts in a tackle,
beats
like,
a man at the bottom,
follows instructions, beats a man, swings in crosses in good areas. Like, these things are coming back in a big way, I think, and they're becoming increasingly important because physical advantages allow you to, both in attacking and defensive senses, commit to covering amounts of ground that I think leverage the amount of risk that you take in specific areas and specific facets of the game. Like, I know one thing we have talked about on this podcast is how having a very big striker allows you to devote more to your rest defense because you need to commit fewer numbers to get up the pitch and you need to commit fewer numbers to generate threat in the box. I think that applies in perhaps less directly noticeable, but still very tangible ways in other positions as well.
Yeah. I also think the real explanation for why it's coming back, and I've got that in air quotes because I do think to a certain extent it never went away.
It never left.
Yeah. But I think to the extent that it is coming back, it's that the modern game is far less transition-based. It's more about states. It's about we possess the ball in your half, then we transition. Then you possess the ball in our half, then we transition, then set pieces, right? Those five phases. The we possess the ball in your half and the you possess the ball in our half is a much bigger part of the game for the top sides. And I think the result is physical advantages are more important because you're operating in smaller spaces. And so a larger physical advantage is the only physical advantage that's going to bear out over short distances in you know, high volume aerial duels. It's I've talked about this before in the podcast. If Aaron is, you know, let's say Aaron can run 5 feet per second and I can run 4 feet per second. Again, don't listen to these numbers. This is just like for the sake of the math being easy. If we run 50 feet, Aaron is going to be 10 feet ahead of me when he finishes. But if we run 10 feet, he's only going to be 2 feet ahead of me when he finishes. So when you reduce the spaces within which you're playing the game, the importance of, you know, just being a little bit faster than someone isn't good enough. You need to be a lot faster than them to score a goal or to prevent a goal. And so I think that is really why physicality is becoming, you know, more important for these absolute top sides. I think it's part of why, you know, dribbly wingers are maybe back in fashion to a certain extent, because just being a great technician is not enough anymore. You need to have that big physical advantage to create chances.
Yeah. I think sort of budget sides or bottom half sides in these competitions are beginning to use physicality as a lever to overcome technical disadvantages. I mean, they always have. I shouldn't say beginning, but they use physicality as a lever to overcome technical disadvantages for whatever clubs in the bottom half can't have players like Kobbie Mainoo, Bernardo Silva. It's very rare, and when they come up, they get recruited by players who are in the top half or in the big teams. But these teams still need to figure out a way to get points in a season. I think a big example of this you've seen is Luton Town, who have the smallest budget in the Premier League by a massive margin. And largely, if you look at their recruitment strategy, it's been about getting players who have outsized athletic impact in specific positions, and then just having enough technical players to meet those physical threats where they're at. And then an out-of-possession approach that simplifies the game for the physical players that they have. And that's obviously a little bit of a reductive description of what they do, but I think you're going to see more and more teams who don't have the budget or the scouting models or the resources to play intricate possession games at the top level go to very, very obvious recruitment of physical advantages in ways that, you know, we've seen managers like Sean Dyche and David Moyes do in the past, but perhaps with slightly different out-of-possession approaches to something like what Moyes does.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything to add there. I agree.
All right. Originally, we were going to do one more question, but I think we're going to save it for next week because we're already coming close to time. But that win really put a rose-tinted feeling on the international break. So I hope you guys have been enjoying this break from football or watching your favorite international team play. And we'll be back next week with some more United content for you to enjoy. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Hope you enjoyed this week's Devils in the Details. You can follow us at DevilsITDPod on Twitter or on a variety of streaming platforms. Our awesome theme music was made by Jacob Connor. You can find at Jacob J. Connor on Twitter. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.